Sefer Bamidbar opens up with Hashem telling Moshe Rabbeinu to again count the Jewish nation. Now Rashi's troubled by a very obvious problem, and that is that this event is happening approximately a year after the Jewish nation left Mitzrayim. And when we left Mitzrayim, Hashem told exactly the count of the Jews leaving. The Jews then were counted, and the number was 600,000 men, add the women, add the children, add the people older, and you have the exact count. Shortly after that was the Chet HaEgel, and in that event, the Torah tells us 3,000 people died. So again, we know exactly where they're holding. And now again, Hashem tells Moshe, count the Jewish nation. And the count is very similar and very comparable to what we would expect it to be. And Rashi is troubled by, so then why is it that Hashem asked Moshe to count the Jewish nation again? Why go through the trouble? Why go through the effort? And Rashi explains why. Mitoch chibason. Because of Hashem's tremendous love for the Jewish nation, he said, count them again. As if to say, imagine a man with a collection of fine watches. He knows exactly which watches he has. He's looked at them thousands of times before. But again, he takes out the watches because he wants to hold them. He wants to look at them. And therefore, Hashem says, count them again because of the tremendous love that Hashem has for the Jewish nation. And that would be interestingly enough. But the Surah tells us something even more profound. The Surah says to us that if you note very carefully here, it says, count the Jewish people, the Beis Avosam, b'mispar shemos. Count them to the names of the family. Here, the expression is not just give them a number, but count the names. And later on, some 38 years later, when the Jewish people are again counted, Hashem says count them, but he doesn't use the expression shemos. There, he doesn't use the names. Here, alone, Hashem says count them by name. And the Surah says, because this dor was nechshav b'shmo, this generation was unique, and this generation was so important that it was worthy to count by name. Hamora al tzuroso ishis, because the name demonstrates the essence of the person. L'ma'alosan, because of their tremendous maila. You see, this generation was unique. This generation had reached such stellar heights that each individual was unique, and their very essence was separate, different, and distinguished. Hashem says, count them according to their names, because the name reflects the individuality of the person. And this generation is so great that I want you to count them by the names of the individual. Which was not true some 38 years later, when the Jewish nation entered Eretz Yisrael. Granted, they were great. Granted, they were very, very tremendous individuals. But they didn't quite reach this level. The uniqueness, the individuality, the separate person being an individual in and of himself wasn't quite there, and therefore they were counted by number, but not by name. And that's how the Sforno explains why the Torah uses the word shemos, names, over here. And this Sforno is quite difficult to understand, because what he's clearly telling us is that this generation, the one that had just left Mitzrayim, was far greater than the next generation that had actually entered into Eretz Yisrael. And that sounds very difficult to understand. Why? Because this generation had been born and brought up in Mitzrayim, the 49th level of Tumah, and whether they reached it completely or partially, but they were steeped in every type of idol worship, in every type of abhorrent and disgusting behavior. That was the society in which they were brought up. Now, granted, they had experienced Hashem for the almost year that they were leaving Mitzrayim, from the beginning of the Makos till the actual Kriyas Yamsuf was somewhere around a year. They got to see Hashem's manifestation in every part of this creation. They got to see that Hashem is the creator and one who orchestrates physicality. And they also got to see and experience Kabbalah Satorah. But at the end of the day, that was but a year's worth of time. If they were 50 years of age, the previous 49 years was not spent that way. And if they were 30, the previous 29 years. The point being, this generation had maybe a year to reach this level. And the next generation spent their life growing and accomplishing. If you were to look at the two generations, we of course would assume that the generation coming out of Mitzrayim was nowhere near as great as the generation entering into Eretz Yisrael. And let's focus for a minute on what that generation, the second one, looked like. Any person who was 20 years of age or older died in the Midbar. That was a decree. Because of the sin of the Meraglim, any Jew who was over 20 died in the Midbar. Meaning to say, the entire generation that came into Eretz Yisrael, almost all of them were born and brought up in the Midbar. What was life like there? So first of all, what did they drink? The Be'er, which was this powerful, huge, large, almost mountain, very large, large rock outgrowth, would follow them in the Midbar. Wherever they went, this large mountain would follow them. And this mountain would stop, the Nasiim would come to it, they would stand on it, and they would take their staff. Each Nasi would take a staff and draw a line, and the water would begin flowing towards the Shevet. But it wasn't a few gallons, it wasn't a little trickle. If there were 3 million people, you probably needed somewhere around 11 million gallons a day. You had many, many behemoths, there were many animals, there was tremendous need for water. But the Medrash tells us that it wasn't just 11 million gallons per day. There were wide tributaries. Each Shevet was camped in its separate area, and you could see rivers flowing out to each Shevet. The rivers were so wide that between the Machanos, between Machane Yehuda and Machane Reuven, if a woman wanted to cross, she needed some kind of vessel, she needed some kind of boat. So if you can imagine an uninhabited area, total barren wasteland, and suddenly the Jewish people come, and suddenly this rock follows, the water travels out, create rivulets, and from that they drink. What food did they eat? They ate mun, the food of Malachim, which was pure, completely assimilated into the body. They didn't need, there was no waste, they didn't need facilities. They were living in a completely, totally unnatural manner. They would be ushered and led by Anne Kavod. An Anan is a cloud, but these Ananim were a bit different. These were pillars of cloud, and these pillars of cloud used to make smooth the ground. They used to destroy any animals that would be dangerous in the path. And wherever the Jewish nation walked in the Midbar, instead of ups and downs, instead of hills and valleys, it was completely smooth. And when they would encamp, it was a perfectly level encampment, with the exception of the one area in the center, which was always left as a mount, and that was where the Mishkan sat. And in the Mishkan, the Jewish people, as a totality, got to experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem would speak to Moshe, and the Shekhinah was Shora. You could feel the presence of Hashem there. At night, there was an Anan Esh that would light up the entire Mishkan. It was literally like a blazing, brilliant light. During the day, it would leave, and it would just be an Anan, but at night, it would be Meir. And every Jew experienced Hashem daily in a most miraculous way. The mun was left, depending on your madrega, closer or further. If you were tzaddik, it was right by your doorstep. If you were benoni, you had to walk out a little bit. If you were you had to take a hike. And more than that, what did the Jews do for 40 years in the Midbar? They didn't have to work for a living. The mun was there. They didn't have to worry about water or even cleaning their clothing, because the Ananim would come and clean their clothing, the food was prepared, their shoes would grow on their feet, their clothing would grow right on them, and it didn't wear out. So they had no issues, nothing to distract them. They didn't have to work for a living. What the Jews did for some almost 40 years in the Midbar was they were in a virtual yeshiva. Hashem says, I could bring them directly into Eretz Yisrael right after Kabbalah Satorah, but if I do that, The Torah won't have a chance to sink into their essence. They'll never have a chance to really absorb it. Let them spend time in this virtual yeshiva. Let them grow. Let them become different so that when they enter Eretz Yisrael, the Torah will have had a chance to sink into their essence. And in fact, what the Jewish people did for all of those years was learn. If you can imagine having the greatest Rebbeim ever, Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron HaKohen, and living without any distractions whatsoever in an environment where there's nothing that's valuable other than learning Torah, because every Jew saw Hashem, every Jew experienced Kabbalah Satorah, and they knew the value of learning. And all they did from the time that they were born until some 38 years later was learn, grow, and accomplish. And I don't know if this requires an illustration, but it's told that in the time of the Chafetz Chaim, there was a 13-year-old boy who had read a very chashuv shirach. This young fellow, at the age of 13, had finished Shas, and because of that, he got a shirach, one of the best young women then. And then, not long after, the shirach was broken. Why? Because it was true that he learned Shas, but it wasn't true that he was 13. He was actually 14 years old. Now, for a 14-year-old to learn Shas is okay. It's not a big deal. I mean, 13-year-old, that's a big accomplishment. That means he's an Eloi. But for a 14-year-old to have learned Shas wasn't that big of a deal. The parents felt they were fooled. The shidduch was called off. But let's focus on what this means. It wasn't that uncommon for a 14-year-old boy to have gone through Shas. And you may say to yourself, how could it be? 14-year-old boy to have gone through all of Shas? Doesn't make sense. But it makes sense if you understand the environment at the time. My Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, was born in Europe. And he described what it was like as a little boy going to cheder. When he was 6 years old, his mother would send him off in the morning with a lantern. You see, it was dark in the street when he left his house. And with his lantern, he would walk in the streets, and he would get to cheder. And he would learn. Well, they'd daven and learn. And then at the end of the cheder day, he'd walk back home again with the lantern because it was dark. From morning, early morning, till dark, this little six-year-old boy sat in cheder and learned, and learned, and learned, and learned, and learned. And that's what everybody did. You start with Chumash, you go through Mishnayos, you learn Gemara, and you keep learning, you keep learning, and you keep learning. And in that environment where there are no distractions, there's no internet, there's no billboards, there's no Game Boys, there's nothing going on, it's not that unusual to find a 14-year-old boy going through Shas, and even an exceptional, a 13-year-old who went through Shas. But as a start point, let's intensify that dramatically by trying to envision what it was like in the Midbar. We're not talking about Europe. We're not talking about Rav Baruch Ber and Rav Shimon Shkop. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. We're talking about Hashem himself clearly showing himself, if it could be. And the Jewish nation as an entity who consider only one thing and one thing valuable, serving Hashem, growing, accomplishing. The greatest glory, the greatest honor is if you could actually learn, accomplish, do. Clearly, in that environment, the Jewish nation grew level after level after level. And therefore, this Sforno becomes very, very difficult to understand. Because very nice that the Jewish nation of the previous generation, the ones who left Mitzrayim, were great. But surely they were nowhere near the level of this generation coming into Eretz Yisrael. The Jewish nation who had been born in Mitzrayim had very little exposure, very little learning. They were primitive in their avodas Hashem, in all of their service to Hashem compared to this next generation. This generation was schooled, they were learned, they were accomplished, and yet the Sforno is telling us that the opposite is true, that the generation coming out of Mitzrayim were on a far greater level. That's the generation to be called by name, singular, unique, each individual. The next generation, they were good, they were great, but nowhere near the first. And the question is, what's pshat? How could this be? And to understand the answer to this, I'd like to focus on a yesod that I don't think is so obvious. Chazal tell us in many places, in many different ways, that no mortal could ever understand the judgment on Yom HaDin. No mortal could ever understand the Omek HaDin, the depth of the judgment. No human being can understand what it's like when we leave this earth and understand the judgment. Now, I want to ask you a simple question. What's so difficult to understand? You add up the mitzvahs, subtract the averas, come to a sum total, and you're done. I'll give you a simple example. I've been spending some time now, there's a Shmooze app for the Android, for the Apple, so I had to spend some time looking at different apps. And there are apps today for everything. So imagine I put on a smartphone an app. What this app does, it counts all my mitzvahs. Every time I do a mitzvah, clicks. Every time I do a sin, it also puts a demerit. End of the day, totals it up, got a total. So why can't you just create an app to count all the mitzvahs, take away all the averas, and at the end of a person's day, you know what he did. At the end of his life, you know what he did. What's so difficult to understand about the judgment in Shemayim? Why is it so hard? And the reason why it's so hard is because the judgment in Shemayim is very unlike the judgment in this world. And let me explain what I mean. Imagine for a minute that Bob killed Fred. Pulled out a gun, shot him down, dead. And the case comes in front of Beis Din. The question that Beis Din asks goes something like this. Witnesses, did you see Bob actually shoot him? Yes, we did. Do you know that Bob was intentional? Yes, we do. How do you know? Well, we warned him, and he said, I don't care. I see, uh-huh. Was Bob aware that, in fact, Fred might die? Absolutely, he was aware. Okay, well, that's not much else that we have to ask, say the Dayanim. At which point the Tohen, the person defending Bob, says, wait, Your Honor, please, I must explain to you. There are mitigating circumstances here. You have to understand that Bob grew up poor. From the time he was a little boy, he had nothing. He would come to school in tatters, ripped up shoes. And Fred was the rich kid. His dad was wealthy and everything was given to him. Why they always would make fun of Bob, he had nothing. And Fred was always that rich kid with the fancy sneakers and a fancy suit. Everything was great. And at the bar mitzvah, it was terrible. Bob had some kichel in the back of a shtiebel over there. And Fred, oh my goodness, on the yacht, two separate yachts. They rented in the whole town, everyone. But that wasn't really the hard part. It wasn't just that Bob was always jealous, always being plagued by Fred. They each grew up, and Fred inherited his father's business, became very, very wealthy. Bob never couldn't make a dime. One day, Bob walked into Fred's office and said, please, I have a wife and kids. I have nothing. Please give me a job, please. And Fred looked at him and goes, loser. Don't you remember in the schoolyard, you were the kid in tatters, you were the kid with the ripped up shoes and I had the fancy sneakers. Don't you know? Don't you remember the bar mitzvah? You're a loser, Bob. You'll always be a loser. Your Honor, Bob lost it. He picked up a paperweight and he couldn't control himself. He couldn't stop. In his total, absolute anger, he killed Fred. But Your Honor, it's justified. You have to respect it. There were other causes. What would Beis Din say? Now, they might in fact agree that Fred was sure a creep, but it's irrelevant. There's only one question. Was Bob mazed? Was he aware of the consequences? Did he intend for this to happen? If the answer is yes, there are no mitigating circumstances. It doesn't matter if it was easy or hard. It doesn't matter if it was difficult or not. There's only one question. Was he aware? Was he conscious? Then he's culpable. And that's din in this world. Din in this world is strictly based on one issue: awareness, cognition, intention. But that's not the way Beis Din Shalmala works. That's not the way the judgment, when we're done our job here on this earth, that's not the way the judgment in the heavenly tribunal works. And to see an example of how different the Beis Din Shalmala is, let's take a little bit of a different example for a minute. Let's imagine for a minute that there's a Daf HaYomi, and there are two men. And every single day, these two men religiously attend this Daf HaYomi. Morning, they're preparing for an hour and a half, and each night, both of them are at this Daf HaYomi day after day after day, and they're extremely devoted. Their family knows there's nothing that comes before it. everyone knows they prepare and they go there, and that's what happens. Now, we'd assume these two men are pretty much equal, right? I mean, they're both there, both preparing, both treat it with the same seriousness. But it's not quite the whole picture. You see, one of these men gives the Daf Yomi, and the other one sits in the back and listens. And you see, the one who gives the Daf Yomi has an extremely clear, brilliant mind. And when he prepares for that hour and a half, he's mastering it and gripping it with total clarity. And then when he gives it over, he additionally gets a new level of understanding. And after 7.5 years, they both have gone through Shas. The man who gave the Daf Yomi understands it, remembers it. He now knows Shas. The one who was in the back there, kind of, to be honest with you, his head was never that clear. He never really could grasp all of the concepts. He certainly doesn't remember it. And after 7.5 years, he kind of, well, he has some familiarity. His time wasn't completely wasted. But they're holding in two vastly different places. One has mastered Shas, and the other one, whatever. But that's not the only distinction. Let's look a little bit deeper. It happens to be that this is the largest Daf HaYomi Shir in Brooklyn. 200 men every night show up to the Shir. But the reason they come is because Reuven, who gives the Shir, is known to be a brilliant Baal Masbir. It's not just that he understands things with such clarity, but he explains it over with such crisp, clear definitions that it's a pleasure. And before you know it, there are 200 men, but those 200 men attending this year are there because of him. So let's revisit the difference between Reuven and Shimon at the end of 7.5 years. Shimon, a fellow who doesn't quite grasp so well, you know, he tried, and he does know something, and he definitely has some reward. But number one, Reuven has Shas. He understands Shas. But additionally, the Chovos Levavos tells us that whatever you do that causes other people to do good or bad is brought back to you. If you are the cause, if you are the catalyst of other people doing mitzvahs, then they get credit for doing the mitzvah, and it comes back to your scorecard as well. You're the cause, you're the reason, so Hashem considers it that which they did counts for them and counts for you as well. Which means that while Shimon attended the shir dutifully and even prepared every day, it was he and he alone. But when Reuven would walk into that room, 200 men walked in because of him. And what that means is not only does Reuven have the credit for his own learning, those 200 men are on his scorecard as well. And again, there can be no comparison between Reuven's 7.5 years of learning versus Shimon's. And in that sense, it's obvious that the Beis Din Shalmala, the upper world system of judgment, is vastly different than here. Any judgment in this world, any judgment by Beis Din in this world, is strictly based on externals. What was done? Tell me the action. I'm not interested in accomplishments. I'm not interested in what happened to others. What did you do? What was the direct outcome? You're responsible for that. But again, Beis Din Shalmala deals with a lot of other issues. What was actually accomplished? What happened to others? But in a minute we'll see that there's way more difference between the way Beis Din Shalmala, the upper court judges, and any judgment in this world. And I'll explain to you what I mean. A little while ago, it was Erev Shavuos, and I got a call on my voicemail from a woman. Now, a lot of times I get calls, and many times they're very serious issues, and I could usually tell either by the tone of the voice or who's calling, whatever, kind of whether it's a very serious issue or not. In this case, I didn't recognize the name, but I figured it probably was pretty important, and I didn't have the time to call right back. Usually I have to allocate an hour or so, whatever I might need, and I just didn't have the time. It was Erev Shavuos, and I just didn't have the time. In any case, we went away for Shavuos, and I drove with the kids. I certainly didn't have time when we were driving. And Motzei Shavuos, I hear there's another voicemail from the same woman again asking me to call her back. And I felt terrible. She called twice. But I really didn't have the opportunity to call back. we were driving back the next day. So we drove back the next day, and again, the kids were in the car. I just pushed it, didn't have a chance to call it back. A third call, another voicemail again on my phone, and I'm really feeling badly, but I really didn't have a chance to call back. Finally, the next day, there's a fourth voicemail. It's Monday morning, and I'm feeling really, not nice. I'm supposed to learn now. I'm going to stop learning. I must call this woman back. It's push it, not nice. 11 o'clock Monday morning, I pick up the phone, and I call her back. She answers the phone. I say, hi, this is Rabbi Schaefer. I'm sorry it took me a while to call, but can I help you? And she says these words, now you call. Now you call. All right, listen, call me in 7 days, Hameivin Yovin, and she hangs up the phone. And I'm saying to myself, oh my goodness. I mean, all right, listen, man, maybe I should have called you back earlier. I tried, but listen, I don't get paid for this. This is a, you know, I try to do what I can. But it's not nice. You don't have to, like, drag me over the coals over here. I really couldn't have called you back, but you gotta dig it in and some mysterious, call me back in 7 days. Will you punish me? My 4 days I kept you waiting, you punished me back seven. I don't know. It really didn't sit well with me. But there was something that was a little strange about the way she said it. Call me back in 7 days, Hameivin Yovin. I don't know. It didn't add up. So I went over to my wife after, and I said, I got a call from so-and-so, a woman. Do you know her name? My wife says, yeah. My wife also said, I don't know if you know this, but her husband just died, and the funeral is at 1 o'clock. Well, as it turned out, I called this woman at 11 o'clock. She was leaving the house on the way to her husband's funeral. And when she said, call me back in 7 days, Hameivin Yovin, she was saying, I'm going to be sitting Shiva, call me back after the Shiva. And I learned a very important lesson from that event. And that is that we human beings don't have a clue. We think we know. We think we understand. When people do things, we judge them, and we're quick to say, he did this, he was holding there, he should have. But we don't have a clue. And one of the biggest differences between the Beis Din Shalmata, the way any judgment in this world is enacted, and the way Hashem judges us at the end of our days, is that Hashem peers into our essence and sees where we are at. Rishol Salanta in his Igeris number 8 in the Musa letter explains to us that there could be two acts. One man could do two separate acts that are ostensibly on the outside the same, but there could be thousands of degrees of difference between them. A man can learn one day and a man can learn another day. One day he sits down for an hour to learn and his mind is clear, understanding. It's a pleasure. And the next day he sits down to learn and he's distracted and it's difficult and it's not going so well and it's very, very hard for him. And he's really pushing himself. Says Rishol Salanta, there could be thousands of degrees of difference in the reward. Lefum tzara agar, it's a mission in Pirkei Avos, in accordance to the pain, in accordance to the effort, is the reward. And the difference can be, again, not twice, not four times, thousands of degrees of difference between one act and another. Where is the person coming from? What does it mean to them? How easy or difficult? What's really going on in their world when they're doing this act? What does it represent? What does it mean? And that difference between upper world judgments and this world judgments is something that we can never really, really delve into. But there's another distinction that's almost as big. And to explain the second distinction, let's focus on the following. Imagine for a minute that I'm davening for the Amud. Let's say it's Rosh Hashanah. And this might take some real imagination. Imagine that I daven beautifully. Imagine I have a nice voice. And I'm singing, and I just can't help but get the sense of, wow, what a melodic voice. Ooh, listen to the ring. Ah, the tone. Whoa, off the rafters. Wow, the gorgeous, gorgeous voice of me, the great Chazan. Wow, I am so impressed with myself. I am so elated with me. That is an interesting example of an internal dialogue, an internal conversation, an internal thought pattern that destroys an action. You see, you may not be able to tell, but if I'm conceited, if I'm arrogant, if when I get up to the Umbud and my only thought is the great me, the wonderful mighty me, hear my tone, I've taken an act and destroyed it from the inside out. You can't see it because you can't see into my heart. But that act is not only not l'shma, it's not for Hashem, it's for my name, my name to spread, my reputation, it's for me and me alone. And the difference between an act done l'shma, perfectly, properly for Hashem, and an act done for me, for my name, can be literally thousands of times difference in the effect. The Or HaTzadikim in Shar Anova says that the difference between a humble man's act and an arrogant man's act can be literally thousands of times difference. He brings an example. The Torah tells us that there are different kind of karbanas, different animals that you could bring as a karban. A rich man can bring a par, beautiful, beautiful cow, weighing thousands of pounds, very expensive. And a poor man might bring a turtle dove, a bird, very inexpensive. No comparison. The bucker could cost, who knows what, thousands of dollars, and the dove a few dollars. And your Chazal tell us, Echad amarbe ve'echad amamit, whether you give a lot or you give a little, it depends on your kavana. If the poor man, that's as much as he could afford and he did it with purity of heart, then it's the equivalent to the 2,000-pound large cow. And explains the Or HaTzadikim, your internal thought process, where you're holding, dramatically affects the act. The act of a humble man can be accepted 1,000 times more quickly, more readily, than that of an arrogant man. The impact could be totally in a different world. So this second element of the judgment of Shemayim being different than the judgment here has to do with the internal track. What did I mean? What was I intending? Was it pure? Was it impure? I gave $1,000 to tzedakah. Very generous, very nice. Well, was it very generous? Or was it just my pursuing my reputation, my honor? I did a great chesed for a person. I went out of my way and drove all the way to Brooklyn back and forth hours. It's unbelievable. What a tzaddik. Well, was that a tzaddik or did I have some ulterior motive? And that ulterior motive doesn't just color the act, it defines it. And the second element of the difference of judgment of Shemayim and any judgment here is the internal track, your kavana, your intention, can make thousands of degrees of difference between one act and the other. But there's a third difference. There's a third difference that the Beis Din Shamala looks at, that the Beis Din Shalmata, that this any worldly court here can never focus on. And to understand that, let's focus on an interesting Mishnah. Mishnah Pirkei Avos tells us that there were 10 generations between the time of Noah and Avram. Every one of those generations, says the Mishnah, were machis, made Hashem angry. Generation after generation were wicked. Not only didn't they do what they were supposed to, they turned l'ra, they turned to bad, and generation after generation got Hashem more angry and more angry, until Avram Avinu came, v'kibel schar kulam, he received the reward for all of them. All of those generations that had done evil, Avram Avinu came, and he received all of their reward. But the Rabbeinu Yonah on that Mishnah says something very, very eye-opening. He says, why is it that Avram Avinu received reward for all of those generations? Because he explains that when Hashem creates a person, Hashem creates for that person a place in Gan Eden for them. If they earn it, it's theirs to keep. If not, it's left unclaimed. Explains Rabbeinu Yonah that these 10 generations of people didn't do what they were supposed to. and therefore their portions were left unclaimed. Comes along Avram Avinu and does everything that they were supposed to do, and he did tov, he did good, keneged, opposing what they had done bad. You see, there was a double issue over here. They didn't do what they were supposed to do, and they did bad, evil acts. Both of those Avram negated. Whatever they were supposed to accomplish, all 10 generations, Avram Avinu accomplished himself. And whatever bad that they had brought into the world, he did good opposite it, so he negated it out. Therefore, it's only proper, it's only roi, that Avram Avinu should receive the entire 10 generations reward. Now, if you think about that, Rabbeinu Yonah, it's very difficult to understand. Why? Because let's assume one man is more efficient than the other. Let's imagine we have people who are digging ditches. One man is so strong, and he's so fast, and he's so diligent that he could do the equivalent of 10 people's worth of work. Wow, amazing, astonishing. What a tremendous worker. But there's a limit. Can he do as much as 100 people? Can a man be so efficient, such a good time manager, that he could do the work of 500 men? He can't. So if you tell me that the Chazan Ish was such a masmid, so involved in learning, that he learned as much as 10 men, okay, 100 men, maybe. But it's not possible. There aren't enough hours in the day. There just is not enough time that one man could accomplish an entire generation's worth of acts. What Rabbeinu Yonah is saying is Avram Avinu didn't just do a city's worth of good. He didn't just do a country's worth, an entire generation, but not just an entire generation, 10 generations worth of people who didn't do what they were supposed to. Don't worry, Avram did all of their work. And everything that they had done on the wrong side, Avram Avinu made up for it by his good. We don't have a system via which that can make sense. Any system of measurement that we're familiar with, the math doesn't add up, it doesn't make sense that one man could be so efficient, so effective, that he does the equivalent of 10 generations of people. So what's pshat in this Rabbeinu Yonah? And I believe pshat is that for thousands of years, man was trying to kill man. It seems that the annals of history are filled with people finding more creative and more clever ways to kill other people. I guess it started with the bow and arrow, a sword, and came the catapults. At some point, mankind discovered TNT, gunpowder. Then he started propelling things. First it was bullets, and then cannonballs, and before you know it, it was shells, and things progressed. World War II was really a battle of logistics. Who could man the greatest number of cannons, the greatest number of warships that would shoot shells, who could drop the most numbers of bombs? But everything was within a certain frame of reference. On August 6, 1945, reality changed for mankind. On that day, the Japanese city of Hiroshima was wiped off the face of the map. An entire modern city was leveled. Smoke, flames, some 250,000 people died. But it didn't just end World War II. What mankind as a totality then recognized was we're dealing with a whole different frame of reference. You see, that bomb was so devastating, caused so much damage, that there was nothing before to compare it to. It wasn't like a lot of gunpowder. It wasn't like a lot of TNT. It was such enormous power that there was no frame of reference via which to define it. And if you'd like to see what a frame of reference would be, imagine you were to try to measure how much TNT would it take to cause that effect. 100 pounds, 200, 500, 1,000 pounds? The explosion on that day was the equivalent of 40 million pounds of TNT in one flash going off. 40 million pounds just destroying a city in a hot flash that reached 3 million degrees of heat. The people within 3 miles of the epicenter were vaporized, literally no longer there. You'd see a wall and you'd see an image of a man, just almost like it was painted against the wall. The man a second earlier had been standing next to the wall, but the heat was so intense that all of the water in his body was vaporized, just turned into vapor, and all that was left was what you saw on the wall, the sort of image of a man. And an entire city was obliterated. And what mankind realized was that we're dealing with something that's a little bit different, not a lot of TNT, not a lot, not even a huge amount, something that's in a different world. Because the bomb that was dropped didn't weigh 40 million pounds. The bomb that was dropped weighed about 800 pounds. And the amount of energy that was released was approximately 1 ounce of matter. 1 ounce, releasing the energy in 1 ounce of matter destroys an entire city. Mankind realized there's something else going on here. We're dealing with a different frame of reference. But as you know, today we're no longer dealing with atomic weapons. We've moved into the nuclear age. And now they no longer measure these type of weapons in megatons or thousands of tons. They're measured in millions of tons. We're dealing with weapons that are thousands of times stronger. We're dealing with weapons that are so powerful that it staggers the imagination. We're dealing with weapons that could detonate with the impact of 50 billion pounds of TNT. And here's the point. Conventional weaponry worked. Conventional weaponry was the standard of measure up until that time. But now we're with a different standard of measure altogether. A different reality. And I think that's a good mushel to the following. I believe that the single greatest mistake that we human beings are prone to, and we make all the time, is when we're asked to define ourselves. Who are you? What are you? What are you? So if you'd ask the average person to define himself, they would say, well, I'm a lawyer, a doctor, an Indian chief. I'm a father. I'm a Rebbe. I'm a chazan. That's who I am, what I am. And the single greatest mistake we make is that we define ourselves with criteria that don't come near to defining the essence of who we are. So here's the question. When you leave this earth, what color are your eyes? What color are my eyes? When I leave this earth, my body's buried. I don't have eyes. Oh. So how tall are you? Well, my body's buried. I'm not too tall. Uh-huh. So tell me, when you die, are you fat or skinny? Tall or short? Muscular or kind of scrawny? The answer, of course, is none of them, because my body's in the ground. I, the one who thinks, I, the one who feel, separate, and forever I am what I made myself into. Okay, so let me ask you a question. Let's say in this world, you were real smart. Really, really smart. I mean, brilliant. Remembered everything, could figure everything out. What happens in the world to come? Are you real smart? Yeah, I must be, because I'm the brain, and I had a good brain, so obviously I'm real smart in the world to come, right? Well, I'm not sure that that's quite accurate, because while I've never been at a autopsy, it is my firm belief that when they put the body in the ground, the brain is still inside the head. You see, the mistake that we make is we assume that I am this body, I am this present entity, I'm at least the brain, that's my thoughts, that's me, right? That is incorrect. I am the one inside, I'm housed temporarily in this body, I have to think through this brain. Sometimes I control the brain and sometimes it controls me. You ever have a thought that you didn't want to have? As in, like, let's say something happened and you got jealous and you said to yourself, quiet, I don't want to think that. But you thought it anyway. Stop that. But you thought it. Stop that. And what's going on? What do you mean you thought it? Aren't you the brain? Well, better yet, you're passing a particular street and something catches your eye and you don't want to look, but somehow it catches your eye and there's an image in your brain. Get out of here. Comes back in. Get at it. Comes like, get, what's going on? I don't understand. I'm the brain. So what do you mean there's an image in my brain that's going to stay there and dwell and come up again and again when I don't want it? The answer is I'm not the brain. I'm the one who's housed inside this body. I have to think through this brain. But when the body's buried, the brain is buried with it, I separate and forever I am what I shape myself into. But it's me, with all of my thoughts, all of my memories, with a total, absolute clarity. Like waking up after a slumber, after a sleep, and you wake up and you see it with total, absolute acuity, brilliant understanding. My body's put in the ground, I separate, and forever I see things with absolute clarity. And this underscores the biggest mistake that we make. We think of ourselves as physical beings, and it's not true. A physical being is limited. A physical being is in a particular space, in a particular time. It's bounded. But I am not physical. I'm the one inside. I'm the one who tells my arms and legs to move. But I am completely, utterly ruchni. I am spiritual. The body is physical. I am spiritual. The body is limited. I am limitless. The body is bounded. I am boundless. And when my body is put in the ground, I separate and I understand things from a vastly different perspective. And from that perspective, I begin to recognize that everything that I thought was so mighty and powerful was so puny. Physicality. Big, strong crane. Big deal. It was nothing. I was viewing the world from a physical perspective. And while I was in it, it looked so big and powerful, but it's so limited, so bounded, limited to time, limited to place, absolutely puny. And when I leave this world, I suddenly remember every event in my life, but I don't remember it as an, remember back then? It's there, every moment, crisply, clearly in front of me, because there's no time. There's no backwards in time, no forwards in time. It's one unit, all there, all in front of me, revealed, and I experience every moment of my life in one exact flash. You ever hear the expression? He was about to die and he saw his life flash by, everything in his life flash by. Now, I don't know if it's accurate or not, but the concept sure is. The concept is because when I leave the body, I'm no longer limited by time, no longer defined by location, and I recognize that I, the essence of me, were vastly bigger, larger, more significant than anything I could ever envision or imagine. Would you like to understand what Rabbeinu Yonah is teaching us in Avraham? Don't make the mistake of viewing the standard of measure by physical things. One act in a physical world is about the same as another. All right, another guy's stronger. He's twice as, he's four times as strong. This mighty man is 10 times as strong as the average. Very impressive. But that's because you're in the physical world, there are limitations. And so if one man is stronger than the other, it's within a very limited, very defined way. But in the world of spirituality and ruchnias, the growth can be exponential, the accomplishments can be vast, and the differences are so great that one human being can accomplish not what 10 men do, not what 100 men could do. One man can accomplish what 10 generations of people didn't do, and he could do good opposite their 10 generations worth of bad events. Because Avraham Avinu in the spiritual world, in the world of Ruchnias, of who he really was, wasn't a little bit bigger than the average man. He towered over them. He was gigantic. He was so gargantuan that you can't use a standard of measure. You can't measure atomic weaponry by TNT. It's almost silly. The scale of measurement doesn't work. We're in a whole different frame of reference. When you're in a physical world, you're in the conventional weaponry. You measure things by ounces, by pounds. When you leave this world and you look back and you understand the spiritual world and you look back on the actions that you did, you recognize that we weren't involved in physical actions. Oh, we did physical actions, but the eye colored them, shaped them, and the body was engaged in huge spiritual accomplishments, And an Avram Avinu could tower over any other man in his generation to such an extent that this superpower could do what 10 generations of people didn't do. And I believe that this is the most significant difference between the Beis Din Shalmala and the Beis Din Shalmata. You see, if Beis Din here judges, it's just based on the physical. Did he kill him? Did he not kill him? Was Bob aware of the consequences? Did he know that pulling the trigger on that gun would end Fred's... Yes, finished. But the upper world deals with a totally different level of issues. Number one, how easy or hard was it for you? And that can make thousands of degrees of difference in the same act. Number two, how pure was that act? Was it completely, l'shem shemayim, partially, not at all? Again, another layer of thousands of degrees of difference between the same act. But the third element is, who was the person doing it? Everyone starts out at a certain level. But what you do changes who you are. If from the time you were bar mitzvah, all you did was what was right and proper, you followed your neshama, Chassam Sofer tells us that you'd reach levels of greatness that'd be hard to imagine. In the introduction to your day, he says that if a human being would just listen to that neshama, he would grow and accomplish. Within a few short years, he'd reach his perfection. But here's the point. Every action that I do, every thought that I think, doesn't just leave an imprint in the world, doesn't just leave an imprint in the upper world, it changes me. So I'm growing or shrinking, changing moment by moment. And in a physical world, you get a little bit bigger, you go to the gym and get a little bit bigger, a lot bigger, you get in good shape or bad shape. But at the end of the day, the difference between a man after 10 years of working out or 10 years of sitting on the couch is one is 400 pounds of flubber and the other is 250 pounds of solid muscle. But it's a very, very defined, very limited distinction. In the world of Ruchnius, when you grow and you accomplish, you could double your size again, double again, and after years of growing, you become a vast giant. You become a giant of such proportions that it's hard to imagine. And what you do in any given act could be hugely different than another man on the outside in the physical world. I can't tell, you can't tell, we don't have a clue. But that's because our app that measures mitzvahs and averas only measures physical world issues. The acts look the same. What he did looks the same. Now with this understanding, let's go back to our example of Reuven and Shimon, the two guys who attend the Daf Yomi every day. Reuven gives a shiur, wow, 7.5 years, master shas. Not just that, he brought in 200 guys. Because of him, 200 Jews learned Daf Yomi. How can we compare his learning to Shimon's? Shimon barely understood. No one else came because of him. No comparison. Except one little thing. Reuven, it was very, very easy. You see, for Reuven, his mind was sharp, always alert, always attentive. And it was very easy for him to come to Shi every day. It was great. It was a pleasure. It was something he enjoyed. For Shimon, it was very, very difficult. He knew that he wasn't accomplishing much. He knew that he wasn't really getting. He was trying his best, preparing for an hour and a half, putting in his everything that he possibly could into it. His heart and soul. And because of that, in the act itself, there could be thousands of degrees of difference between what Reuven did and what Shimon did. But there's another layer. How pure was it what they were doing? To be honest with you, Reuven, well, he kind of did enjoy the honor. And he couldn't but help notice how people, you know, gave him that title, oh, Talmud Chacham, and what a great shiur. And even his wife, when people meet her in the supermarket, oh, your husband gives the best shiur in Brooklyn. Ooh. And he kind of did have a little bit of a conceited sense of self. Oh, the great me, my Daf HaYomi shiur, oh, me. And, oh, come, let's sit down and let's learn from me, the great me. And for all we know, Reuven might have eaten up the essence of every word of Torah and filled it with decay. Whereas Shimon wasn't getting much honor, wasn't getting much glory at all, quite the opposite. And it could be that there, again, are thousands of levels of difference between purity of Reuven's act versus Shimon's act. But there's another layer. Who were these two people? Well, I forgot to tell you. Reuven was a great, great flowering potential Talmud Chacham when he was in grade school and surely in high school. Every Rebbe he had said, this guy is going to make it. We're going to hear, he's going to be maybe a Gadol HaDor. Brilliant head. And he has no distractions. It's so easy for him to learn. And he learned. In high school, he was doing phenomenal. And he learned and he learned and he loved it. And he was growing and everyone knew about him. And he was doing phenomenally well. And he got to Beis Medrash. And he was steiging and growing and mastering unbelievable amounts of learning with Ian, Bekias. And second year Beis Medrash, he says to himself, you know what? I really would like to have a nice house, you know, and a fancy car. And, you know, I could get a job like most guys, you know, but I don't want just a regular job, you know, where I can just earn a living and then, you know, take care of my family. And you know, I'd like a corporate, you know, I'd like to be a corporate lawyer because they make big bucks. And, you know, I can't just be a regular corporate lawyer. It's got to be Harvard Law. Otherwise, I'm not going to make partner. And if I really want to live in my fancy, you know, mansion and really drive my BMWs, et cetera, I got to make partners. So he stops learning in second year Beis Medrash and he goes off to his plan, goes to Harvard Law, and now he's finished law school. Listen, I'm not a bum. I'm going to sit and learn. And so he learns, he prepares, and he's both best of both worlds, right? Corporate lawyer, spends 80 hours a week in the office, and the rest of the time he prepares Daf Yomi and gives a shiur. Best of both worlds. Except one problem. Do you know who he could have been? Do you know who he should have been? Had he lived the life that Hashem planned for him, he should have been a giant. And he's now a Lilliputian. He's a puny little nothing. So it's not just that his actions were easy for him or not easy. Not just they were pure or not pure. Who is he? Who should he have been? How much of his potential is he reaching? What is this person? And as it turns out, that Shimon, this is about as good as it gets. He tried in high school, tried his best, didn't go so well. Sat in Beis Medrash a few years, really tried. But his head wasn't clear, not because anything he did, just wasn't gifted. He tried, he did, he learned, he got a job, and now he's accomplishing 80% of his potential. But you see, you and I don't see that. We see Reuven, the superstar, giving the biggest shiur in Brooklyn. We see Shimon, the Nebuch. And what we don't see is the entire inner track. And I believe that that's pshat in the Sforno. You know what the difference between the generation leaving Mitzrayim and the generation coming into Eretz Yisrael was? The generation that left Mitzrayim were brought up in the absolute depth of Tumah. In one fell swoop, they grabbed themselves by the bootstraps, they pulled themselves up, they said, Hashem hu Elokim, and they experienced Hashem and said, this is Emes. The Mitzrayim lived through every one of the Makas, and the Mitzrayim denied Hashem. The Mitzrayim saw the blood, they saw the water turn into blood, they saw the frog, they saw everything, and they denied Hashem. But these people, the Jewish nation, saw Hashem, and they accepted, and when they were on Har Sinai, they reached forward, they pulled themselves as close as they could be, and what they did was they changed their essence in but a short time, but they made themselves into great people. The generation after, born in the Midbar, oh yes, they accomplished, they did, but it was easy. The whole society was going that way. Their whole world was focused that way. Everything that they had seen since the time they were born pointed them in this direction. So it's very nice that they accomplished, very nice that they did, but how much did they really change? How much were they forced to choose? Did they have to fight against their society, their world? The generation that had been born in Mitzrayim had to give up everything that they had experienced, everything that they knew, everything that had been their world. The generation that was born in the Midbar had it way easier. All you got to do is follow the system. It's going to take you. Now, if you follow it, it's great. It's wonderful. You accomplish, no question about it. But how much of you did it demand? How much purity was in there? How much did you have to reach into the essence of you and make difficult decisions? And the Sforno says, because of that, there's no comparison. Yes, the generation coming into Eretz Yisrael were great, but they didn't have to exercise anywhere near as much effort. They didn't have to really pull at the very essence of them, and as a result, they weren't nikra b'shem. They weren't unique individuals by name. They were nowhere near the same level. And I believe that this Sifurnu is a very eye-opening concept on a number of levels. Let me give you one that may be obvious. Baruch Hashem, we live in a time when there are many, many Balei Tshuva. And sometimes it's almost a little sad, because sometimes you'll see a person who changed his world, fought against everything that he had seen. He went to a shir, heard a lecture, and said, this is true. And he began accepting, began keeping Shabbos, began keeping kosher, began keeping mitzvahs, began learning. And he had to fight against his whole world, his parents, his upbringing, society at large. And he grew and accomplished. He gets married, has a family. And by the time his son is in sixth grade, the son knows how to learn better than the father. Now, the father, what could he do? He spent a year in yeshiva, as much time as he could, but he had to go get on with his life. He tries to learn now, but by the time his son is in sixth grade in a regular yeshiva education, the son knows how to learn better than the father. And sometimes you have the son look at his father and go, yeah, dad's a good guy and all that, but come on, he's in Amoritz. You know, he doesn't know anything. When I wrote this up, someone read it and said to me, it's not true. She said, I'm a balas tshuva, and it's not true. When my daughter was 6 years old, she read Hebrew better than me. It didn't take until sixth grade. And you see this. You see this with kids. Surely by the time a son, a boy, if he's a bright fellow, by the time he's in high school, he's learning Ksos, he's learning Nesivas, he's learning Shas Be'in, and his father lags behind. And sometimes the son or the daughter can have a sort of sense, look, dad's a good guy and all that, but come on, about you, he's not really on my level. I'm a little embarrassed about who he is. My friends, I'd like to share with you what this son is saying. Son, you may master Shas and Poskim, and it could well be that your Shas and Poskim is not worthy of the same level as your father's Chumash and Rashi. It's very impressive that you followed the system. It's very impressive that the society you were born into considered Torah learning very important. And it's great that you continued and you resisted the outside world. But how difficult was it for you? All your friends were doing it. Your parents supported it. But you know what your mother did? You know what your father did? They turned against the very world in which they were born, the very society that brought them up, and they said the words, this is wrong, I know what's right, and they changed their essence. They changed who they were. What the Sforno is telling us is, you're judged by the criteria of you. Where are you coming from? How sincere are you? How much are you putting into that act? What does that act mean to you? Where are you compared to where you started? So many factors that we human beings can never see. We see the outside. We see the external. What's going on in the heart. What's going on in who the person is. What's going on in accordance to their potential. We never see. And that's an important application. But I think there's way more. We human beings tend to be judgmental. I know. Just, you ever need to know where somebody's holding? You ask me, I'll tell you. I know. I know where he's holding. I know where things are at. And that gets us into trouble sometimes. And sometimes it gets us into big trouble. I'll explain to you what I mean. Right now, I'm very involved in a series on marriage. I'm trying to put together almost a curriculum so that young marrieds don't make the mistakes that they are making now on a regular basis. And because of this, I give a weekly call-in radio show that I ask people to send in questions. And recently I gave a shiur on respect. Now the Rambam tells us that the essence of a happy marriage, the man has to respect his wife more than himself and love his wife like himself. The wife has to respect her husband exceedingly. And says the Rambam, she has to look at him like a king and treat him with exceeding honor. And explains the Rambam, if those two pieces are in place, you'll have a happy marriage. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that the glue of marriage is love. When you take two human beings who are so diverse in temperament and nature and outlook, put them in the closest living proximity and demand from them to live in peace and harmony as one, if there isn't love in that marriage, it's doomed to fail. If there isn't love, then everything he does, he's a creep. He's a worthless creep, whatever. If she loves him, if he loves her, and there's a connection, if there's a bond, he's a good guy with a flaw. There's no question he has a flaw. Good guy with a flaw. She's a wonderful woman with an issue. And they live together in harmony and peace. But if that bond of love is lacking, it will be Gehenim in a very short amount of time. But what the Rambam is telling us is another yesod, and that is that love alone will never carry the day. There's another element that must be there. The husband must respect his wife more than he respects himself, and the wife has to look at her husband almost like a king. He has to treat him with exceeding amounts of honor. We don't have time to get into the why that has to be there. It has to do with the nature of the human. But let's understand what happens when it's not there. What happens when it's not there is I start looking at my wife as, you know, she's a nice woman and all that stuff, but come on, I gotta respect her. To what she does, to what she says. And the husband, you know, doesn't quite respect the wife. And the opposite, what happens when the wife no longer respects the husband? You know, I mean, he's, you know, okay guy, but come on. Barely learns, you know, he's often late for davening, and he's not really, my father was a masmid, and he was on time for davening, and he was a mensch. This guy, I can't really respect him. What happens when the respect isn't there? Besides everything else, the love very, very quickly leaves, because if you don't respect a person, how could you love them? I don't respect you. How could I love you? And besides the clear message that the other partner gets that I don't respect you and the damage that does to the marriage, you can't love a person that you don't respect. And that becomes a big issue. And after this particular share about respect, I got a lot of emails asking the following question. How could I respect my husband when he does this, this, and this? How could I respect my husband when he's not this, this, and that? How could I possibly respect my husband? Interestingly, all of them were from women about their husband, but I believe it carries both ways. And I'd like to answer that question. The answer to that question is, you don't have a clue. You're judging on this world's standards. I believe that my husband should be learning 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day. I believe my husband should always be on time, late, never late, and punctual. I hold, based on who my husband is, this is where he should be. But guess what? We don't know. And we don't know where that person's at. We don't know who they really are. And the Rambam says you're obligated to treat them with honor because that's the way Hashem created the system. And Chazal say you're obligated to do it because we don't have a clue. And how many times do you hear about a serious Talmud Chacham, a person who's really holding in levels, very holy Jew, wonderful, except one little problem. He's a little too demanding at home, a little too, you know, tuckish. And every time he finds his wife doing something not quite proper, he makes sure that she knows it. And before you know it, the Shalom Bayis is down the tube. And before you know it, they're yelling and screaming and fighting. And disastrous. He learns 3 Sturm a day. Very impressive. And he comes home at night, and when no one's there, he yells and she yells and she yells and he yells and he yells and back and forth and back and forth. And he and she both are over so many Isurim, they violate so many Torah principles that it's hard to begin counting. Onaz Dvarim, oppressing someone. You have to love a fellow Jew like yourself. Don't hate your friend in your heart. Lo Sikom, don't take revenge. Lo Sitar, don't bear a grudge. And if it's not Barabim, but certainly you're embarrassing her. What about all the violations of Lashon Hara? And you could have a person who all day long, very nice, learns, and he comes home at night and literally eats up everything he did during the day by acting with his wife in a way that's not quite right. And so I'd like to say to these women or to the men, if you have trouble respecting your spouse because of that reason, not on the madriga that I wished him to be, not doing what I thought you should have, it's time to realign our focus. It's time to recognize that we don't have a clue. And this person who I look at as a not a big deal might be huge. If you look at the Reuven and Shimon in that example, Reuven, what a guy. Gives a Davi Yomi 200 people, and he knows Shas. What a respectable. His wife looks at him with such honor. Wow. But how do you know who he is? And look at Shimon. Not a big, impressive guy at all. He might tower over Reuven in the world to come. What this Sforno is telling us is the system of measurement is not in the external world. The external physical world is very corporeal, very physical, very limited. The generation coming out of the Midbar, the generation who walked into Eretz Yisrael, yes, they learned all their years, but they didn't reach the same level as did the earlier generation because they didn't make themselves into it. They were born into it. And it's very nice that you'd like to have someone who's different or whatever, but you don't have a clue. You don't know how pure, you don't know where they're holding, you don't know where the essence of that person is, and we human beings never have an understanding whatsoever. May Hashem grant us the ability to understand this, to put this into practice, to live it in ourselves and in everyone else we come into contact with.